This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Rex Heerman kept checklists for everything. According to prosecutors, he kept checklists on how to kill, how to clean, how to destroy evidence, how to keep the noise down while doing it. He allegedly maintained planning documents on his own computer, a literal blueprint for what he did, allegedly. Filed away like an architectural spec sheet. This is a man who, if prosecutors are to be believed, treated killing the way most people treat a home renovation. Methodical, sequential, organized to the point of obsession. And now, according to multiple sources familiar with the case, Rex Heerman is reportedly preparing to take the stand, or rather to stand in Suffolk County in a courtroom and plead guilty to murdering 7 women. Think about that for a second. A man who allegedly spent decades building a system designed to avoid exactly this moment, who used burner phones, who allegedly timed his crimes to when his family was out of town, who, according to investigators, searched online for information about the very investigation trying to find him, has apparently decided the best way to move left on the board is to say the words out loud, to admit it to every single charge. This is not a man who broke. This is a man who did the math. But I'm curious to get your thoughts in the comment section as we work through this and try to figure out and examine why now. Why now, Rex? Links are in the description. Substack, YouTube, weigh in. Heerman, the 62-year-old former Manhattan architect charged with 7 counts of first-degree murder in the Gilgo Beach serial killings, is expected to change his plea at his next court appearance on April 8th. According to sources who spoke to the Associated Press, NBC News, and multiple other outlets, the victims' families and Heerman's own family have reportedly been notified. His defense attorney, Michael Brown, and Suffolk County District Attorney Ray Tierney are reportedly negotiating the terms of a deal. The expected outcome is life in prison without the possibility of parole. Here's what makes this so striking. Just months ago, both sides said publicly there would be no plea deal after Judge Timothy Mazzei denied key defense motions in September of 25. D.A. Tierney told reporters there'd been no talk of a plea. Brown said the same. Heerman had entirely and entered rather a non-guilty plea. They were preparing for trial and a discussion. The trial was set for September 26, right after Labor Day. The prosecution had filed its statements of readiness. Everything was headed towards a courtroom showdown that would have been one of the most closely watched criminal trials of 2026, and really in New York history. So what changed? Everything and nothing. The sentence didn't change. Life without parole was always the ceiling. New York doesn't have the death penalty, so the maximum punishment Heerman faces is the same whether he pleads guilty or gets convicted at trial. The number doesn't move, but the math around that number, what happens between now and that sentence, changed dramatically, and it changed because Rex Heerman ran out of doors. Start with the DNA. This was the defense's primary strategy. Challenge the science, challenge the lab, challenge the admissibility of the evidence that tied Heerman to 6 of his 7 alleged victims. The prosecution's case relied heavily on whole genome sequencing, a cutting-edge forensic technique used by California-based Astera Forensics to extract nuclear DNA from rootless degraded hair samples found on or near the victims' bodies. Traditional forensic DNA testing companies compares about a dozen genetic markers. Whole genome sequencing examines tens of thousands of variations across the entire genome. It is powerful. It's relatively new in criminal court, and the defense wanted it gone. It's icky. It's yucky. It's witchcraft. I think they called it witchcraft, but they were very much like, yeah, you know, we this everything. They didn't like it because it's more accurate than what's been done in the past. It makes it more absolute of a verdict against Huerman than anything in the past. So if you do what you do, if you're a defense attorney, you're going to go after that. This hasn't been used much, yeah, because it's new. And it's better than anything in the past. At some point, everything is new in a courtroom. At some point, fingerprints were new. This is just the latest. It's just far more identifiable. We could clone you out of the information we have. Not just identify you. The judge held months of hearings. The legal standard in New York for determining whether scientific evidence is admissible. They're called Frye hearings. Experts testified on both sides. And in September of 25, you may remember this, the judge issued a 27-page written ruling. The DNA stays in. They were fighting all last year to get that DNA out, get that new technology out. The science is sound. The evidence is admissible. The defense's first and most important challenge failed. So they're down one of their big things that they needed. So they tried again. Brown filed a second motion, this time arguing that Astera Forensics lacked a New York Department of Health permit required under public health law. That an out-of-state, non-permitted lab shouldn't be allowed to offer evidence in a New York criminal proceeding. The judge ruled on that one, too. Denied. The court concluded that public health law restrictions don't apply to forensic laboratories used in criminal investigations and that the DNA was collected constitutionally with no violation of Huerman's rights. Two swings at the DNA. Two misses. The evidence linking Huerman to the victims wasn't going anywhere. Then came severance. The defense pushed hard. They wanted the case split into as many as five separate trials. The argument had some surface logic to it. The killings allegedly spanned from 93 to 2010. The victims were found at different locations. The conditions of the remains varied. Brown argued that trying all the charges together would create an overwhelming cumulative effect that no jury could fairly parse. It's a fair argument. The judge, however, didn't buy it. The judge ruled that the cases were, in legal terms, inextricably interwoven, connected by geography, victimology, forensic patterns, and digital evidence, including those burner phones and internet searches. One trial, all seven victims, three decades of alleged killing, compressed into a single proceeding. This Friday on ABC, TGIF is back. That ruling alone changed the calculus fundamentally. In a single trial, the prosecution doesn't just present the evidence for each victim in isolation. They weave it together. The planning document found on Huerman's computer, the one with the checklist, the one prosecutors described as a blueprint for how to commit murder and get away with it, doesn't just apply to one charge. It sits over all seven like a shadow. The pattern becomes the story. And for the defense, pattern is poison. The defense also moved to dismiss the murder charge related to Sandra Costella, whose remains were found in 1993, the earliest of the seven alleged killings. The argument was that the evidence tying Huerman to that specific murder was insufficient. That motion was still in play. But if the plea reportedly covers all seven charges, it suggests the defense assessed their chances on Costella the same way they assessed everything else. Not good enough. Add it all up. DNA admissible. Severance denied. The weakest charge still standing, a 723-page evidence inventory on the prosecution side, cell phone records placing Huerman in contact with victims before they vanished, internet search history that investigators described as documenting a fascination with violent content and an obsessive interest in the investigation into his own alleged crimes, and those burner phones, according to prosecutors, devices used to contact dozens of S workers kept physically near Huerman's personal phone, creating a digital trail that walked right up to his front door. When you look at it that way, the question isn't why Huerman is pleading guilty. The question is what a trial would have given him that a plea doesn't. Allergies, excuse me. The answer legally is nothing. The sentence is the same. Life without parole. That doesn't change with a jury verdict. But what does change enormously is what happens in the space between now and the sentence. A trial would have lasted months. Every piece of evidence the prosecution assembled over years of investigation would have been presented in open court, broadcast, analyzed, replayed, the search history, the content of those internet searches, the planning document, read line by line. The testimony about what was done to these women, the torture, the mutilation, the dismemberment, the prosecutors have referenced in filings, all of it performed for the public record and a national audience. A guilty plea compresses that into a single proceeding. The evidence exists, it's in the record, but it doesn't get the months-long theatrical presentation that a trial demands. For a man who spent his entire alleged criminal career managing what people saw and knew about him, that distinction matters enormously. And then there's the family. Hearman's ex-wife, Asa Elrup, finalized their divorce. His daughter, Victoria, publicly stated that she believes her father is most likely responsible for these murders. That's an extraordinary thing. Your own child, on the record, saying she thinks you did it. A trial would have dragged them deeper into the spotlight. Subpoenas, testimony, media coverage that would follow them for the rest of their lives, more than it already has been. A guilty plea doesn't erase their connection to the case, but it may limit the exposure. It may be the last thing Hearman can offer them. Not innocence, but at least the absence of a prolonged public spectacle. There may be deal terms that haven't been made public. Reporting indicates that Brown and Tierney are actively negotiating, but the parameters remain unclear. Plea agreements can address facility placement, conditions of confinement, specific charge structures. A negotiated plea gives the defense leverage to shape the terms of what comes next in ways that a post-trial conviction simply does not. Once a jury speaks, the defense has nothing left to trade. And there's one more piece that legal observers should watch closely. The appeal waiver. If Hearman has gone to trial or had gone to trial and been convicted, the whole genome sequencing ruling would have been a prime target on appeal. Novel science, first-time admission in a New York criminal case, a lab without a state permit, defense appellate attorneys would have circled that for years. Doesn't mean it would go anywhere, but they would have tried it. A guilty plea, by its nature, largely forecloses those challenges. Hearman waives the right to contest the DNA admissibility. He waives the right to challenge the severance ruling. He accepts the outcome. Why would that benefit a defendant? Because it ends the fight completely. No years of appellate proceedings. No hope dangled and withdrawn. No legal limbo. It's over. And depending on what the prosecution values, certainty of outcome, sparing families from a trial, closing the case permanently, that waiver may be part of what the defense is trading for whatever concessions are made on the table. But underneath the legal strategy, there is a psychological architecture to this decision that is impossible to ignore. Rex Hearman, according to the prosecution's theory of this case, lived a double life for approximately 3 decades. Architect by day, husband, father, commuter on the Long Island Railroad. And then allegedly something else entirely when his family left town, a man who prosecutors say targeted vulnerable women specifically because he believed they wouldn't go to authorities, a man who kept his world separate with a precision that bordered on compulsive. Compartmentalization isn't just a word you attach to someone like this. According to prosecutors, it was allegedly the operating system. Burner phones kept in proximity to his real phone, but never crossing over. Crimes allegedly committed only during specific windows of family absence, planning documents stored on a personal computer in the home where his children slept. It's a lot of control. A guilty plea fits that pattern. It is, in its own way, the final act of compartmentalization and control. It is the last decision Hearman gets to make on his own terms. He doesn't sit in a courtroom for months while prosecutors systematically dismantle the constructed identity he maintained for decades. He doesn't watch that identity unravel publicly, piece by piece, in front of cameras and a jury and the families of the women he allegedly murdered. He now decides when and how this ends. for a person who allegedly organized the most horrific acts imaginable into checklists and timetables, the timing of this is, well, it makes sense. The thing that may be most psychologically unbearable isn't prison. It's the loss of control. The loss of control that a trial represents. A trial's unpredictable. Rex was not. Witnesses say unexpected things. Evidence lands in ways you can't script. The narrative belongs to the prosecution. A plea hands at least some of that narrative control back. Then there's his health. Huerman missed his March 17th court appearance due to undisclosed medical issues. His attorneys confirmed he'd been using crutches for over a month, but declined to elaborate. If there's an underlying medical condition and there's no public information confirming what it is, the psychological calculus shifts. A man who may be confronting his own mortality alongside a life sentence makes different decisions than a man planning a years-long or decades-long legal fight. If the plea does go through on April 8th, it will close the criminal case against Rex Huerman without a trial. It will spare the families of Melissa Bartholomew, Maureen Brainerd Barnes, Amberlynn Costello, Sandra Costello, Valerie Mack, Jessica Taylor, and Megan Waterman from sitting through months of testimony about how their loved ones died. But it will not close the broader Gilgo Beach story, not even close. In December of 25, police arrested Andrew Dykes and charged him with the murder of Tanya Jackson, a woman known for years as Peaches, and her young daughter, Tatiana. For over a decade, investigators assumed they were victims of the Long Island serial killer. They weren't. Dykes was the child's father. His name was on the birth certificate. The same DNA genealogy technology that identified the victims led investigators directly to the man who allegedly killed them. Ocean Parkway was not one killer's dumping ground. It was a corridor used by multiple alleged predators. And some of those stories are still unfinished. As for Huerman, if this plea is accepted, he will reportedly stand in a courtroom and admit to killing seven women. Seven women who vanished between 93 and 2010. Seven women who were young, who were vulnerable, who were, according to prosecutors, targeted specifically because the man who allegedly killed them believed nobody would come looking. He will reportedly have to say their names. He will reportedly have to acknowledge out loud on the record what he did. For some families, that acknowledgement, forced, negotiated, strategic as it may be, is the closest thing to justice this case will ever produce. For others, no courtroom proceeding, no plea, no sentence will ever be enough. Both of those things are true at the same time. And that's the part of this story that no legal strategy, no blueprint, and no checklist can resolve. The architect spent his career designing structures meant to stand. His final design is the controlled demolition of his own defense. Built not to win, built to manage the wreckage on the way down. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. I'd love for you to weigh in. And we'll continue our conversation right there. Links are in the description. Press subscribe. Wherever you're listening, so you don't miss any of the cases we follow for you right here. We'll continue the conversation in the comments. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.